started to look at the beginnings of Revelation chapter 5 now 3 weeks ago. And we saw this incredible vision that John has seen now that he has gone up and he is now standing in heaven. So I wanted to just take a couple of moments to sort of go over those first five verses that we talked about last week. Remember, as he's there, really what he's seeing, and we said that one of the important things about Revelation is there's multiple books that you can't really separate it from, but one of the key ones that seems for some reason to not be mentioned as much is the book of Exodus. And when you're in Revelation and you're seeing all of these things, what you're seeing is a sort of John's view of pretty much what God laid out there in the book of Exodus, in particular all of the events that surround Sinai when the Jews get there. We're on that part of our study on Wednesday nights. We had a really cool study this last Wednesday. We looked at the Song of Moses, which really was the song of all the people, and we talked about this incredible aspect of what was going now that the people have come through the sea and are now headed towards the quote-unquote promised land. And it's just amazing. And what they're about to see when they get there, it's going to be in a very short while, but what they're going to see is basically what John is seeing, because he's seeing the actual model by which the tabernacle setting that will be modeled in the tabernacle that God will give to Moses. So we've been looking at this very carefully and trying to understand this, keeping in mind, as I've said now repeatedly throughout this, you have a Jewish Jesus talking to a Jewish John. It is not in Greek. Sorry, it's just not. They would not have communicated that way. The phrases and the terms that we're used to seeing, being Western in our thinking, are we need to sort of step back and really try to consider it from that particular perspective. Because when you do, all of a sudden the book of Revelation comes alive. Now, we spent a lot of time looking on this and these statements that Jesus would have made. We talked about the Aleph, the Tav, the first and the last letters of the Hebrew alphabet. He would not have said Alpha and Omega. That's what John would have recorded because his readers would have understood that. But Jesus would have said he's the Aleph Tav. We took a lot of time to look at what that means back in the Old Testament. Basically, it's the A and the T of the Hebrew alphabet, which is the first and last letters of those alphabets. So he's the beginning and the end. He's the first and the last. And it just goes on and on. We don't have a big time to hear to get into the whole Hebrew thing. But it's very important to understand that, because when John would have heard that I am the Aleph Tav, he would have been immediately taken back to Genesis chapter 1, the fourth word of that verse, which is Elohim bara et Aleph Tav. So he would have seen that and would have been immediately taken back that the one that's creating is in fact the one that he's encountering now in heaven, who is saying, look, I am. This is who I am. And so as we moved through this, we talked about the other thing is that that God throughout the scripture, that the menorah becomes very important, very significant when you look at all of these things because of the seven things that are involved there. You have the seven feasts, all of them with Pentecost being right in the middle, the three spring, the three fall. We're going to be talking more about that here in a few minutes. So you've got the whole menorah thing going on. When John gets there, he sees this menorah. He sees Jesus walking among seven branches of that menorah. And we talked about how from our perspective, it looks like he's walking around a circle of seven. But that's not what's being described. It's how we would understand it, because our minds can't grasp this non-dimensional aspect of what John is beholding. Jesus is not walking around in a circle of these things. He is these things, and he's in the midst of these things. We're going to see that again here in just a few minutes. And so all of this stuff that's going on, when John beholds this and is called up into heaven, he's actually seeing the tabernacle. Now, it's important to understand, because we know that the Jews, while their wanderings in the desert, that God established a mobile temple, as it were, to go with the people, and that would be the place where he would meet with his people on their journey to the promised land. That's where the word tabernacle comes from, to dwell. And so God would make his dwelling amongst his people, and it was that tabernacle, which we're going to take some time on Wednesday nights when we get to that point. We're going to look at all of those things. But what you find is that God is very clearly telling Moses to follow the pattern that he received. Where did he receive this pattern? When he was up on the mountain. And believe me, it was really tough this week. I was looking at all these verses and I'm thinking, man, should we go back to Exodus? But we're going to do that on Wednesday nights and I'll tie it in as we go on Sunday mornings. But it's really interesting because we have this idea that just Moses just goes up on top of this cloudy mountain and he's up there in sort of the mist, you know, like he's up on, you know, Mount Everest or something, up there in the mist and all this. And then all of a sudden he comes carrying these two stones, you know, with the Ten Commandments on them. But what we're not picking up there was what Moses experienced there in the presence of God. And what's really cool about it is you read that when Moses got up there and he got into the cloud, that God doesn't do anything for 6 days. It's on the Sabbath day that God ends up speaking to Moses and starts laying all of this stuff out. So this pattern that Moses received was apparently given to him while he was on the mountain. In fact, it says that, the pattern that you received when you were on the mountain. So is it possible, we're not told this, but is it possible that Moses saw what John is seeing, and this is what he brought down the pattern for? So when they built the tabernacle, that it was a direct representation of the one that's in heaven, where John the apostle is now standing. I mean, this is really fascinating when you start really thinking through all of this stuff. So now he's up there in heaven and he's beholding this. He's got the throne. He's seeing the surrounding, you know, the throne being surrounded by the four living creatures. We talked about the representation of what that means and stuff. Those, the representation of the man, the lion, of the of an ox and of an eagle, and of course representative of the gospels and all of this stuff. And there he is again, right in the midst of all of this. And again, you got to get this in your mind. It's not a big circle with him in the middle. It's not just in the midst. It's in the midst. It's like who he is. That's what's being described. So there's this amazing thing. And then as he's beholding all of this stuff, all of a sudden there's this mighty angel. We're not told who the angel is. We don't know. I don't even know if I want to make a guess. I would say probably Michael, but who knows? Possibly Gabriel. As the messenger of Messiah, he seems to show up every time you're talking about Messiah. We don't know, but whatever. He's running around in heaven, if you can run in heaven, but you get the idea. And he's got this scroll. Now, we talked about this a few weeks ago, and what we said is it's really interesting to me, and I know you guys have heard me say this before. These guys that do translations, I wish they would just stop, because they drive me insane. The word is not the word for scroll. He's not coming around with a scroll. It's Biblos, which, yes, we get Bible from it. It's a book. It's not a scroll. The reason the translators do that is because they're thinking back in New Testament times and Roman times, and they had scrolls where they would roll the scroll. You know, you all seen the pictures of it. And then the seals, of course, or the wax and all that. That's not what's being described here. That's what these guys are seeing, because they're looking at it once again from a Western mindset, the Roman mindset, and not taking into consideration that you got a Jewish Jesus and a Jewish John. This thing was in the book form, and these seals, when we get there, you're going to see that they're quite different, I think, than what we've been led to believe. Not that there's anything wrong with what we've learned in the past, but I think there's a different meaning that's going on here that is lost. So there's all of these things. So this angel is coming around with a book. And what's interesting, in the 10th chapter, when we get there, we're going to see another angel. And this time he's carrying a little book. And there it's the same word translated book. So what's up with these guys? Wish they'd make up their minds. I guess they thought it was easier to eat a book than it was to eat a scroll in chapter 10. Who knows? But it just drives me insane when they do this. And literally, the Hebrew New Testament, the Brit Hadasha, it actually has book, and so does the Syriac Peshitta. They both translate it as a book, not a scroll. Okay? So interesting stuff. So this is what's happening. But the problem is the angel's carrying this book around. It's sealed. It's closed up. There is nobody who's qualified to open this. Now, we spent some time looking at this, and we talked about the significance of what this means. Now, I touched on this, but I want to sort of reiterate this. Where is John? He's in heaven. He's probably beholding what Moses probably saw there on Mount Sinai. We don't know about Moses. We do know about John. He's in heaven. He's seeing all of the angels. We know that God's Spirit is there, and even the one sitting on the throne. And yet we're told no one in heaven, on earth, or under the earth is qualified to open the scroll. Now, wait a minute. How can the one on the throne not be qualified to open this thing? Because we're told no one. That's because it's the Redeemer, the redemption side of who God is. It's really interesting when you really stop and think through this. Even the one on the throne wasn't qualified. And at this instance, from what John was seeing, no. There's another part of this that's got to come in. And again, because of who we are and where we live and the frame of existence that we see a throne, and then we're going to see a lion, and we're going to see a lamb, and the lion and the lamb turn out to be the same one. Oh, wait a minute. The lion and the lamb are the same one, actually turn out to be the same one on the throne. And we're like, what the heck is going on? Well, that's because you ain't in heaven, man. So we're doing the best we can to noodle through all of this stuff and try to get an understanding. So, but nobody's qualified, and John weeps. John says, I began to weep. And the word there we talked about is not just, you know, a couple of snivels. I mean, he was breaking down, not breathing, kind of crying kind of thing. And I mean, because he understood the significance, the weight of what was happening here, that no one was qualified. And we talked about when you read the Hebrew of this translation, it's very straightforward. It's very hardcore. The angel says, stop crying. Okay? Stop sniveling. There's no reason to cry. Relax, dude. There is somebody that's qualified. And then the lion is described, remember? And then there's the lamb as though it had been slain. So in other words, you got the whole theme of resurrection coming on here. You got the whole theme of redemption taking place. You got all of these different things that are happening all at once. And John's doing the best that he can, the same as you and I would do if we were trying to describe something that's indescribable. How do you describe this? Paul taught us, look, you, no eye has seen and ear has not heard. It hasn't even entered into the heart of man the things God has prepared for. So how was somebody that's seeing this supposed to describe this? I mean, think about it. So we're doing the best that we can to sort of meander through this and really get an understanding. And so that's sort of where we are. Now, we tied this all in with the concept of this menorah, of a non-dimensional menorah. And remember, the midst, everything is in the midst of this. And right around the sort of, from our perspective, a center, if you want to call it that, there's the four living creatures. And then outside of that is sort of the 24 elders, remember? And then it goes on beyond that. So this is all happening, but it's the same kind of understanding where Paul told us. We talked about that tabernacle that God had Moses build in the wilderness. Remember that place where God would meet? Paul tells us that you and I are that place now. There's no longer a need for us to have a building to meet God. As I've said 1,000 times, this is a stinking building. That's it. This is not the church. We are the church. Our God dwells in us. Now try to wrap your noodle around that. How can he be with me and be with you? When you were having a great day the other day and I'm laying under my truck, scraping my knuckles up and beating on that stinking starter, trying to get that thing going. How can he be in both places at the one time? And as you're praising God and I'm, well, not. I mean, how is that even possible? Do you see? How do you do that? And at the same time, he's with our brothers and sisters over there in Mozambique and in Thailand and all over the world in Belize. How is that even possible? So you begin to get the picture. How is this happening? But that's what's sort of being described there. Our God, I love this fact about God. A lot of people are frustrated with that. Why doesn't God just help us to understand? Well, why? I love the fact that God is only knowable as he reveals himself to us. Wouldn't it be a drag if we could sort of know everything about God that there is to know? And just say, oh yeah, I've read this book. Yeah, good book. Put it away. I mean, I love the concept that our God is so much bigger than who we are, in particular who we think we are. No matter how much we study, how many languages we know, how many of all of this other stuff, he's always bigger. And I love how he's constantly revealing himself. And I told you before, I really believe in this Zephaniah passage that in the latter days, I'm going to restore a pure language. I think we're in those days. There's a specific language that is pure. And I believe that to be the Hebrew. I've said that before, so we'll just leave that at that. But I just love how God is beginning to sort of show us all of these things. And it's interesting, the uptake in interest on studying these particular, in particular that language, because it's just unbelievable. When we get settled, we're going to get back into that. We're going to have some fun with this stuff. Because you can't believe that this, if well, some of you can because you've seen it, but you can't believe how amazing a simple word strung together, letters strung together that make words can absolutely be. Oh, I gotta share this with you because this was awesome. I was telling Danny Wednesday night. We got this whole thing, and I may be wrong on this, but basically what happens is the Song of Moses, in the Song of Moses, it talks about how God blows. He blows through his nostrils and splits the water for the people to go through, right? And in the Hebrew there, the word is literally, he just blew, and the waters parted and walled up on both sides, so much for this thing they drowned in the Sea of Reeds, which is 6 inches. Not much of a wall, right? And Pharaoh's army should probably learn how to swim if they drown in 6 inches of water. Anyway, but he blows and the water split and the people go through. And then, of course, we know the story. The armies of Pharaoh go into this, and we read again that God blows and the waters close in them. But what's interesting is when he blows on the water to separate for Israel to go through, the word that he uses to close it up is puff. So he goes and opens the waters for his people to go through, and then the Egyptians go in, and it says that God goes. How cool is that? You don't pick that up in the English, folks. You only see it in the Hebrew. That's what I'm talking about. And that's what we need to understand. So you got this whole thing that's going on here, and doing our best to try to understand a scene that, unless you're actually there, we're not going to understand it. So we got this angel flying around, and John's been weeping and crying, and the guy's like, stop, stop, stop. There is one, and that's what's being described here, and that's where we pick the story up. And I looked, and behold, in the midst of the throne, John says, and of the four living creatures, and in the midst of the elders. Notice it's starting from the center, going out. Important for what's going to take place here in a little bit. In the midst of the throne of the four living creatures, and in the midst of the elders, stood a lamb as though it had been slain. So the lion has been described, and now, here, of course, is the lamb. So in the midst of Revelation chapter 5, you have both the story of redemption in the Lamb of God, right, who took away the sins of the world. You have the story of redemption who redeemed us. We're going to be talking a little bit more about that here in a few minutes. But you've also got with the lion, you've got not just the redeemer, but the reigner, the one that reigns, the lion. He's the king. He's the one that's over this kingdom that Tom was talking about earlier this morning. So you've got this whole thing going, but it starts in the middle. And in the midst of the elders stood a lamb as though it had been slain. So the idea here is that this thing at one point was slain. It was dead. And here it is standing there. So you not only have the concept of redemption, but you have the concept of resurrection. Boom, as John is seeing this. Now John had witnessed it from our perspective as well, hadn't he? Remember, he was the one that went into the tomb. When him and Peter ran to the tomb, remember, on Sunday morning. That Sunday morning, Resurrection Day. And John, we're told, outran Peter. John was probably some little skinny guy. He's a Denny. He's a runner guy. John, Peter was probably a Rick guy who probably got there and couldn't catch his breath and was leaning on the wall as John goes inside. And John says, what's going on? I mean, John got to see this. The angels, what are you looking for the dead among the living for? Now, think about this from John's perspective. He was there that day from this side of eternity and seeing this, and he's going, look, this is what he talked about. Peter, this is what he said was going to happen. Ding, ding, right? And this is, all of this stuff is going on. And that same guy now is actually standing there seeing this in ultimate reality. You see, we're always convinced that our world, our life experiences are reality. They are not. The reality is in the life to come because it's eternal. It's infinite. This one is not. It's temporal at best. So, and yet we live as if this were the reality. And we get everything we can out of this life so that we can do whatever. And we seldom give thought to the process of what we're sending up there to heaven, where the reality is. So anyway, so he sees the lamb as though it had been slain. Now notice what happens. And he's having seven horns and seven eyes. Holy smokes. We could spend the rest of the year, no question, on each of these phrases. We don't have time to do that. We just don't. It's taken already, 5 years we've been in Revelation? And I don't know how long. But anyway, so we're going to do, sadly, what we have to do in this particular setting. That's why the Wednesday nights and stuff are so good, you guys, because you get a chance to meander and noodle through all of this stuff. That's what's cool about that setting. versus this particular setting. Seven horns. So with number seven, we said when we started our study of the book of Revelation, we're going to see this repeated over and over and over again, this number seven. Now, I know we have been taught that it is the number of perfection. Get that out of your brain, because that is not the perfect example. Perfection is not what's being described in the number seven. It is completion. Okay? Absolute completion. Whatever it was, when you get to seven, that means it's complete. There's nothing more, and certainly nothing less. It's seven. It's complete. Okay? So the concept of horns now we know, understand the seven concept of completeness. Horns always speaks of power. And we could do a whole thing through the Old Testament and the horns. And you have to understand, they're not talking about like the ram's helmet's horn. Okay. On the altar, there was these little protrusions that stuck up, kind of bowed out like that, I guess. These were considered the horns. And it was there, the representation of the power of God. That's what it was all about. And Abner actually goes running there and ties himself to one of those things as David is taking over, because he knows he's doomed. And he says, you know, he ties himself to the horns of the altar because he's going to, you know, this is where the power of his God is at. And of course, he was right. He just shouldn't have done what he had done. But anyways, so the concept of horns being power. So in other words, whoever this lamb is, we already know who it is, right? I was going to try to keep you in suspense, but you probably already know. Anyway, so this lamb that had been slain had complete, absolute authority. That's what's being described here. And he had seven or complete eyes. In other words, he had absolute, complete perspective. There's nothing hidden from his eyes. Like the psalmist wrote, it doesn't matter where I go, in the heights of heaven, in the depths of the sea, into the depths of Sheol, you are there. God is just that. He's God. It's hard for us to grasp that, but he's all places at one time. That's what the theologians call omnipresence. That means he's all places at one time. He's like oxygen. He's everywhere. Oh, he's not in the water then? Yeah, because there's oxygen in the water. It's what fish breathe. Go figure. Anyway, so seven horns, complete power, complete perspective, and they're also the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. Now, I looked at the passage in Zechariah. I was going to bring it up and talk about it, but if I did, I'd get lost in that passage, and we would never get back to Revelation. So I'm just going to give you a synopsis. In chapter four, of the book of Zechariah, Zechariah is seeing a vision, and he's told by the angel, what is it that you see? Oh, I see a seven-branched, literally, ours says lampstand, but it's literally menorah. Imagine that. The concept of the menorah. It's throughout the scriptures. It's not just this really cool thing you picked up when you were in Israel, like I have in my office. Okay? It's not just this really cool looking little lampstand. This is everything. It's everything from God's perspective. So he sees this menorah, but he sees more than that. There's pipes that come to each of these things with a source of oil that keeps them lit at all the times. And he doesn't understand what it is, what he's seeing. And so the angel says, well, this is the seven spirits of God, and they're going out into the earth, and there's judgment. And then lo and behold, what we're going to see in Revelation as we move forward, there's also around that lampstand, or on the sides of the lampstand, there's two olive trees. We're going to see those when we get over to chapter 11 in the book of Revelation. Because like Exodus, you can't separate Revelation from Zechariah. Remember, we looked at Zechariah with the flying scroll. He also saw a flying scroll. And he saw that scroll before the judgment of Babylon and the nations. I mean, so you can't separate these things. That's why the book of Revelation is the only book in the scripture that has that promise for all that read and do and trust in it, that they're going to be, because it's the culmination of everything that has come before it. Revelation brings it all to a close. So these are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. So we could do some study on Isaiah chapter 11 and look at the seven spirits of God, wisdom and knowledge and so on and so forth. But then what's being described here is this lamb. Now notice that he's looked and he's saw it in the midst of the throne, and in the midst of, all of a sudden there's the lamb in the midst of the midst. I mean, can you try, you know, to see what's going on here? It's just all of a sudden there he is. Why did John not see him before? I don't know. I wasn't there with John saying, dude, how come you didn't see that before? I wasn't there. I don't know. But it's really interesting because now he sees this. And then he came and he took the scroll out of the right hand of him who sat on the throne. Once again, the one sat on the throne up until this point, for whatever reason, was not qualified to open the scroll because he wasn't functioning in this capacity as the Redeemer. Okay? This is just, I hope you understand how difficult it is when you study these kinds of things and you read them, and I hope you do on your own, to try and condense it down into a 40-minute sermon. I try. I don't do so well. There is so much. And then you waste your time during your sermon trying to describe how difficult it is to narrow this stuff down. Anyway, it's just a real challenge. It's you have all of these amazing things that God has been showing you, and it's like there's no way possible to lay this all out. So you do the best you can, and you try to get it out there, and just pray that you guys just go, wow, like I went, wow, as you're studying this. Anybody that's done this and all these resources we have. But he comes and he takes the scroll out of the right hand of him who sat on the throne. Again, right hand authority. We could get into this whole Sephirot stuff, and we won't even go there, because man, would we be lost in the tree of life, and man, ooh. Someday we're going to have to take a Sunday and look at some of this stuff. I'm just trying to figure out how to put it so we can. I don't mean to say that you guys aren't going to understand. I'm trying to say, how do I get all this into a presentation? It's just, man, there's all kinds of stuff happening. Now, when he had taken the scroll, so notice now what's happened. There's a scroll and nobody's qualified. The lamb shows up, who was the lion, and now he's appearing as a lamb that's been slain. So he's redeemed and he's been resurrected. And now he goes and he receives the scroll, okay, from the right hand, from the hand of authority. So the one on the throne is the only one that has the authority to give this scroll. I should quit calling it a scroll, call it a book. He's handing it out to him, right? So when he had taken the book, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each having a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. Now remember, we talked about coming from the outside, the elders, the living creatures, the throne, the Lamb in the midst of all of this stuff. Now notice what's happened. It's reversed. It's reversed. It's moving out now. So it's like it comes in and then it goes right back out. Because now, once the book is in the hands of the one qualified to break the seals, to open and to act upon the things that are written there, which of course we know is the Lamb, and that's going to be important as we move through this, because we always have this idea that it's the angels that are doing this. Oh, it's the four writers of the apocalypse, you know, and in the first four seals, and it's the angels, John. No, no, they don't do anything without being told by the one that has the authority to do it. It isn't the angels. They're just carrying out their orders. But the orders are coming from none other than the Lamb, because he's the only one qualified to open it. So you got the four living creatures and 24 elders fall down before the Lamb. Now notice what's happening. Each having a harp. Now that word harp is katharos. And yes, if it sounds familiar, we get guitar from it. So it is not as oftentimes, it's not a dang harp, you know, as some, you know, we always have this picture of people with wings on their heads and stuff. And, and so that's what they're showing. That's not what the word is. This wasn't a harp of David, or it was something to do with it. This was what's described as what we would know a stringed instrument, which is why they use the word harp, by the way. But it was actually a guitar. So how cool is that? I get to play acoustic in heaven. That's going to be awesome. Hopefully they'll have acoustic basses there as well. But anyways, so everybody has one of these things. So we were talking just the other night with someone about these religions that say you can't have any musical instruments. What are you going to do in heaven? Because whether it's a regular harp is irrelevant. The point is there's musical instruments there. What are you going to do? Oh, but see, they cast them down. Yeah, they cast them down because they weren't able to play because they were consumed with the one that they were worshiping. It's got nothing to do with the things being bad. But anyways, we'll leave that for another time. Each having a harp and golden bowls full of incense. These were what we would call a fire pan, basically. It wasn't really a bowl. You know, it was like carrying around a cereal bowl, a massive thing that I eat Captain Crunch out of. I'm totally into health cereals. I even get the ones with vitamins, Captain Crunch, with crunch berries. That way I get my fruit at the same time I'm getting my cereal. And this bowl, Marie says, that's not even a bowl. You're eating your cereal out of a trough. I'm okay with that. And the golden bowl, so it's not a bowl. It's a fire pan. And the incense, and we don't have to guess. We're told what this is. It's the prayers of the saints. When you go through the whole scripture and you look all the way back at the tabernacle, the temple later, and all of the stuff, the whole concept of incense, you know, we think of incense as some sweet-smelling stuff to cover another odor that we would rather certain individuals didn't smell, right? I grew up in the 70s. We'll just leave it at that. But that's what we think of when we think of incense. But the incense to God, the concept of this burning smoke and being raised up to God, was always representative of the prayers. That's why the priests had to take care of the altar of incense in the holy place. Not the Holy of Holies. It stood right outside the Holy of Holies. It had to be taken care of. The incense had to be changed. And the incense was specifically, they were specifically told how to make the incense. They couldn't, you know, bring in their own formulas, in other words. It was very apparently smelled a lot like cinnamon. So, but because there's a lot of cinnamon that's involved in. But anyway, and that's why some of the priests in the Old Testament, they concocted a different kind of incense and God slayed them for it. No, I'm not accepting that. I mean, God didn't mess around in the Old Testament. Thank God we live under grace, huh? But anyway, so the incense is burning, and it's because incense is always rising, and you get this concept of prayers rising up before God, and God sort of inhaling it, sort of taking it in. See, we oftentimes, I know at least myself, we take prayer for granted. We just do. I mean, it becomes sort of a duty or an obligation. And we get this concept that there's this time to pray, and we set it up, whether it's early in the morning or whether it's late at night or whether it's at some point during the day. Nothing wrong with that. Now, don't misunderstand. But don't get the idea that God is only interested in hearing from you at 5:30 in the morning. And based on whether or not you spend, you know, half hour, an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours on your knees or whatever, that God says, well, that, now that's acceptable. I mean, come on. That's our concept of prayer. But the concept of prayer is a constant communication between yourself and God. It's just this constant thing, right? Like the son and the daughter to the father, just this constant communication that's going on. But we compartmentalize it because that's what we do in the West, in particular in the West. So we have these times set aside, and we should. I'm not saying they're wrong. Please don't misunderstand. Rick's saying I don't have to have quiet time. That's not what Rick's saying. Just don't think that that's it, and from there you can get up and be about your day and not worry about anything else now because you've spent your time with God. Come on. Come on. What is devotion to God? It's the direct result of someone devoted to God. Isn't devotion, being devoted, a constant and not just a, you know, a specific set time? Anyways, so that's what's going on here. These are the prayers of the saints. Now, this is really important to catch this. And they, who's they? Not everybody, it's the saints. So there's a song of redemption that takes place. There's actually three songs in these short few verses here, and they're really significant. The first one comes from those who've been redeemed. What's interesting about this is we read through this, if you don't identify who the they is, that what you understand, if you do identify who the they is, that none of the angels, the four living creatures are singing this song. It's only the saints, those that have been redeemed. And they sang a new song saying, you are worthy to take the book and to open its seals. Now, let me jump back to a couple of weeks ago when we looked at this in verse 2 of chapter 5. The angel is first, John sees the scroll, the book, and he identifies it, and there is just the Hebrew word, chachtamayu, is what he says. But then in verse 2, as he's talking about the angel begins to describe and ask who's worthy, then you add that aleph tav to it, because the book is clearly belonging to the one who was the first and the last, the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. The same one. The book belongs to him. That's who, what's going on here. So you are worthy to take the book is that same phrase that comes in there with that Aleph Tav. So this book is not just any book that's available to anyone. It has his signature on it. Remember, the significance of this is like huge. Because over and over again we read in the Old Testament, I'll just use Ezekiel 9, I know we've talked about it in the past, where God sends out the angels for judgment on the earth. And he says, but I don't want you to do that until you have marked those that weep over the condition. In other words, those who were repentant, right? When they're marked, and that word marked in the English is the Hebrew taf. Now the Hebrew taf is a cross. So even in the book of Ezekiel, God is saying, I want you to go and I want you to bring judgment, but do not do it until my remnant is marked, and they're marked with a cross. This is the book of Ezekiel, man. Some 400, 500 years before Jesus even showed up. And the reason that's significant, you're going to see it again in the book of Revelation. Mark, do this until the seal is on their forehead. What seal? The cross. It's really amazing to me when you start to see this, that God has told us all along what's happening here. And yet we've tried to, you know, whatever, and theologize it and doctrinize it and all of the other stuff, which we should, but we miss, at the expense of that, we miss understanding what's really being said. What would this have meant to John? He's the one receiving this, and Jesus is communicating with him. I mean, this would be so significant to this guy. It's hard to explain, because he would have grown up understanding these things, just like you and I have grown up with Sunday school and understanding Jonah and the whale, and, you know, whatever, fill in whatever Bible study you want to put in there. We're familiar with those things. So imagine that in your whole life, and of course, it was drilled into these guys, and now all of a sudden, you're witnessing all of this stuff that you've been taught, but you're seeing it firsthand, and not from an earthly perspective. And all of a sudden, the Ezekiel passages, the Zechariah passages, the Daniel passages, my goodness, Exodus, holy cow, he even went to Genesis. I mean, do you see? The lamb that has been slain, Isaiah 53 would have just jumped all over John. I mean, it's hard for us to grasp this, what this would have meant to him. And as he's recording these things and writing these things, as he's told to do, by the way, and presenting them to us, what they would have meant to him. We got to take our Western mind out of this, because we haven't, you know, created any real problems, because there's nothing heretical in it. But man, it's caused us to miss what's really, really happening here. I love this stuff. Anyways, so they sang a new song. You are worthy to take the book and to open the seals. Remember, before nobody was qualified. He's qualified, not just to receive the book, but to open the book and its seals. And then the whole concept of the seals is going to lead to the trumpets, and the trumpets are going to lead to the vials. And I mean, you got this whole seven thing going on. It's just incredible when you start thinking about what's happening. So you're worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals. Why? Because you were slain. You gave of your life. Again, there's Isaiah 53. John is seeing this. He's hearing this now from the redeemed, of which he's a part. He's hearing all of this. And all of a sudden, the gears are starting to come together. Unlike my starter on my truck with my flywheels. I'm not meshing and I have problems now. But anyway, and they sang a new song. You are worthy to take the book and to open its seals, for you were slain. Notice past tense. You were slain. But remember, there was a lamb who had been slain, and he's standing. So obviously, is resurrected. For you were slain and have redeemed us to God by your blood. Now, let me do another thing. When you look at this word, this concept of redeemed, I'm glad they used that word here. Some translations say purchased. Purchased, there's nothing really wrong with it, but it doesn't give the whole concept. The word behind redeemed, not in the Greek, but in the Hebrew, means to gain something by paying its debt. So it's not like going into Walmart and just going, gee, I like that shirt, and paying for it. That shirt owes you nothing. That shirt owes nothing. It will sit there until you come to purchase it. But if you go and help someone who is in debt and is unable to pay the price, and you pay that price for them, for whatever case may be, that's redeemed. That's what's being described here. For you have paid their debt. They owed something that they could not pay. Sound familiar? But you have dealt with this. You have taken care of this. So purchase, it's okay, but it's, the depth is just not there. It's really interesting. And have redeemed us to God by your blood. There's the payment. Remember, blood in the scripture. Don't think of the ooey gooey sticky stuff that separates the plasma when it's laying on the floor. Though that is a part of it. Whenever you see the word blood, think life. Because the life is in the blood. Without blood, there's no life. So we have this tendency, we're going to be celebrating communion here, we have this tendency to always think of it as blood and ooh, you know, stuff that people look at it, over they go, right? But that's not, it's the concept of life. You can't separate the two. And you've redeemed us to God by your life. The redemption price. His life for ours. The great exchange. Right? This whole thing that's going on. His righteousness for my sinfulness. My account of debt has been wiped clean, and now I've got an account on my record of it having been paid in full. All because of what this one has done. And have redeemed us to God by your life or blood out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation. Now here, if you're into missions, this is a biggie. Okay? Because this purchased or paid for debt can be applied to all that receive. This is why we go into mission. This is why we take this message to places where it has not been. And I get the same old excuse all the time. Well, what are we doing out there? There are people around here that know. Good. Go tell them. If there were people in Mesquite or anywhere else in here, then why aren't you telling them instead of griping about us as a church supporting missions in a foreign land? If there are unsaved people here, great. You take charge of them and make sure that they hear the message. But there's always this comparison. Oh, your church, you guys got stuff going in Africa and Belize and all over the world, and yet we got the homeless people here in town. Yes, we do, and we should minister to them. But for those people that say that, great, go help that guy out. I mean, come on. This is everywhere in the U.S. So we're going to go out there to those places as Jesus told us to do and bring that message where it needs to go. Out of every, I love this, not some, not most, every tribe, people groups, the concept here, every language. Man, is it going to be awesome in heaven when we're all standing around the throne singing and there's every language singing the praise all at the same time of our God, all of those languages. Can you imagine what that's going to be? That is stunning. You ever heard that? I know you have, if you listen to any of the Christian stations. How great is our God, Chris Tomlin song. I mean, it's a great song in that, you know, in the English one. But have you heard, well, I'm sure that you have, and it's a dumb question, but that world version of that song, oh my gosh. It just, every time I hear that, I almost have to pull over. It's just hearing those words. I don't understand the thing these people are saying, but it's like, oh my gosh, they're just, it's all going up to heaven. And as cool as that song is, and to me it's awesome, as cool as that is, in heaven, we're all doing it at the same time. And you're going to be standing there singing next to some dude from Russia, and on the other side is a guy from China, and a guy in front of you is from Africa, and a guy behind you is from the Philippines, and all their voices are going to be going up, and you're going to hear all the languages, but you're going to understand everything because they're understanding what you're saying too, because we're praising this one. Every language. Oh man, just wait till we get further on in Revelation. And have redeemed us to God by your blood out of every tribe and tongue, people and nation. It's complete. It's the whole gamut. He didn't just come to die for some, which some would have us believe. He came to die for all. So you've got this interesting concept that's going on. Now, another really cool thing. Remember we talked about this connection back with Exodus and all of the stuff that's going on. And I'm going to have to just touch on this. There's no way to develop this because, again, this is another, would take a life. But the Messianic Jews, many of them, in fact, I would say most of them, are also seeing in this whole concept of seven and the menorah. Because remember, when they think menorah, they don't just think of a lighted candlestick like we talked about. They think of the seven spirits of God. They think of, you know, blah, blah, blah. But they also think of the Moedim. Now, if you remember what the Moedim are, the Moedim is the translation we call feasts. And if you go back to Leviticus chapter 23, verse 2, God says, these are my feasts, my Moedim. But Moedim doesn't mean feasts. It means appointed times. In other words, these are the times that I personally have chosen. And so you have seven of them. And if you're looking at the menorah, I'm looking backwards from you guys. So it would go the Pesach, the Passover. It would go unleavened bread. It would go first fruits. The tall one in the middle, Pentecost, because the Pentecost is the summation, according to the Jews, of Passover. And then after that, the last three, you have trumpets, you have Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement, and then you have tabernacles. So in all of this, because of their perspective on all this, as given at Mount Sinai, they're seeing this whole thing that's happening here in this revelation, and they immediately tie it back. And what's just been described of God's Moedim are the first three, right? Passover, the death on the cross, unleavened bread, his burial, and then first fruits, the resurrection, and then Pentecost, his giving us his spirit. They see in that God's Moedim being described in this song. That is awesome. That is absolutely awesome. Because what's going to come are the three remaining. We still haven't seen the fulfillment of them. We saw the others to the day in the life of Jesus on his first coming, right? Oh, we're going to see it in the second. Well, it's already been described. There's the lion dealing with the second half and then the lamb dealing with the first, because the first is redemption, second is to reign. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And you could totally get wrapped around the axle. When we get to the seal, we've seen the seventh sealed book, but we're going to spend a little more time looking on that. Again, we think Roman, a rolled up seal with seven wax things with the ring posted on that, because that's what commentators see. But did you understand? Remember I said that we also see in the book of Revelation what? It's a marriage. You see this all the way through it. It's a ketubah, the marriage ceremony. Right? All of this stuff that takes place that leads to the marriage supper, because they're two completely different things. And you can see this. And interesting, if you remember when we were looking at this, about Jesus in particular with his bride, that what he would do is that when for the contract, there had to be seven signatures on a marriage contract. Oh, yeah. So we could just go on and on and on. Enough of that, because we've already looked at that. But notice that he's purchased, he's paid the debt for anybody that would accept or be willing to receive that payment, right? Through faith. Verse 10, and you have made us kings and priests to our God. Well, that's exactly what Peter tells us. The kings and priests, we rule. Why? Because we're child of the king. It's like Tom was talking about again with the kingdom and stuff, and you've heard me say, are you a child of the king or not? And believe me, I looked in the mirror doing things that I shouldn't be doing, because I say it all the time. If you're a child of the king, act like it. Oh, Satan is getting me down. You're a child of the king. Stop. Stop. If Satan is giving you a hard time, what do? Punch him in the face. You're a child of the king. For God's sake, act like it. That's what I say to myself, and I'm saying it to you too, but trust me, it's coming back at me. It just makes me so mad because I'm such an idiot. Anyways, and have made us kings and priests to our God. Man, I keep saying this, but can you see the depth of what's being described here? Oh, that's cool. We're going to be kings and priests. Isn't that wonderful? Oh, tell me, dude, we don't got to walk around in those priest things. Right? Please. But look at this. The fact that God would take those that he has redeemed and made them kings and priests, that should make you go, wait a second. There's a perspective that God has of me, which is hard, almost impossible for me to grasp. He wants to make me a king and a priest? What? Especially when you look in the mirror all the time. It's absolutely stunning. And we shall reign on the earth. Now, let me talk about verse 10 here just for a second. Some of your versions that are you're reading, if you're not reading the one on the PowerPoint, will say, has made them kings. So there's this big debate. There has been, really, since the English translations came out, as to whether or not this should be translated as us or as them. And everybody tries to explain why they have the right perspective. It seems to me that it's a song of the redeemed, therefore it must be in us. It's as simple as that. To say them, it's like you're talking about somebody else. Well, we already identified who is the they that are singing. It's not the angels. We're going to see they had many. And they've got their own song that they're about to launch into. But this is what's going on. So I just don't see it. I mean, whatever. It doesn't really matter. Whatever it is, we know that what he did at redemption is good, so it really doesn't matter. But you'd be surprised how many of the arguments are over this kind of thing. Because some translations say us, some translations say them, and so to me it's, well, the redeemed are the ones singing, so it has to be in us. And we shall reign on the earth. Talking about that kingdom concept once again. The promise of Jesus that, you know, of what he's going to establish. Now notice, then, after the song of the redeemed, which we've now taken some time to look at, then I looked and I heard the voice of many angels. Now the angels are starting to speak. Around the throne, the living creatures and the elders, and the number of them was 10,000 times 10,000 and thousands of thousands. In other words, there was a lot. Okay? There was a bunch of these folks. Way more than you could even begin to comprehend to number. Now, we're familiar with this statement because in the book of Jude, we have Jude quoting a similar passage. What Jude is doing there is he's quoting a book which is called Enoch, okay, the book of Enoch. And the book of Enoch, and as long as Jasher and Jubilees and a couple of these other books, have, for whatever reason, not found their way into the canon, okay? But there was much to be learned from there. Now, for those of you that are on Wednesday nights, you already know this because you hear me refer to them a lot, and Denny refer to them as well. I call them authorized texts. And what I mean by that is that they are all books that the Bible itself quotes as authority. Okay? So that's why I'm saying authorized texts. I'm not saying inspired. Okay? I am saying authorized. Jude quotes from Enoch. I forgot where the other one is, but anyway. And then in Samuel, we're told of the book as it is in the book, as it's written in the book of Jasher. So that's what's going on here. Now, the reason I wanted to show you this in the book of Enoch is just because of what's being described here. If you've ever read this book, and you can, it's available to everyone, and it is stunning. If you've ever been confused about Genesis 6, with the Nephilim and the whole thing that's going on there, read Enoch and you'll understand why. And you'll understand also why people go, ooh, I don't want to read that stuff. Well, too bad. It's there. And it was written before all of these others. Hello. Okay. We even know about Enoch from the scripture, who he was and what he did. So obviously he was something. God took him. He was not, for God took him. So that tells us something. Anyways, but we live in a day where theologically we shouldn't, you know, take these apocryphal books and blah, blah, blah. You can't translate, right? Why should I listen to you on that? But anyways, there's some amazing stuff. But there's a description, and the Jews hated the book of Enoch, especially after Jesus was here. And do you know why? Because in the book of Enoch, you clearly see Jesus, period. Before there was a Noah, there was a Jesus. Enoch very clearly describes it. And so there's no way the Masoretes are putting this in. It's not happening. Because then they would have to fess up. So anyway, but Enoch talks about this. And I just wanted to show you this. It's really interesting. We're just going to read it. We're not going to take it apart. I'm going to try not to take it apart. And he will summon all the hosts of the heavens, all the holy ones above and the host of God. The cherubic, that's the cherubim. The seraphim, that's the seraphim. The ophanim, that's the living creatures, okay? And all the angels of power and all the angels of principalities and the elect one and the other powers on the earth and over the water on that day shall raise one voice. Notice that day. Was he looking at what John is describing for us in Revelation 5? Don't know. Now watch the seven that comes out. Where are we at here? Elect one. And the other powers on the earth and over the water on that day shall raise one voice and bless and glorify and exalt in the spirit of faith and in the spirit of wisdom and in the spirit of patience and the spirit of mercy and in the spirit of judgment and of peace and in the spirit of goodness. Seven spirits. I mean, it's being described. I just thought that was really cool, so I just wanted to put it out there to show you. And in the spirit of goodness, and all shall say with one voice, blessed be he, Baruch Hashem. Blessed is he, and may the name of the Lord of spirits be blessed forever and ever. Forever and ever. We're going to see it in our study as we continue here in Revelation here, as I don't take any more of my time. Guess how many times it shows up in Revelation? Yeah, you guys are really on top of it. Yeah, seven times. Imagine that. Blessed is he who reigns forever and ever, the eternal one. The beginning and the end, the first and the last, the Aleph Tav, the Alpha Omega, whatever you want to call him. It just is mind-boggling. We're going to see the third of seven here. We saw one back in Revelation 4 and earlier on in chapter 5. So now these angels, these myriad of angels, that is just a huge number, saying with a loud voice. It's interesting that he writes with a loud voice to me. Because it seems to me, if there was this number of angels up there, regardless of what their station is, then they're all saying anything at once, it would be loud. I'm just saying. But if they're, I mean, this is just going to reverberate through the cosmos. Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and riches and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and blessing. He, now notice what's just happened. Do you remember back in chapter 4, the one sitting on the throne? The same thing was said about the one sitting on the throne. Well, I thought he handed the Lamb the scroll. Yeah, again, go figure. How do you grapple with something like this? Because it turns out that the Lamb is the one sitting on the throne. Well, if he's the one sitting on the throne, how can he hand it to the Lamb? Who was on the throne? All right. Stop! I have no idea. And obviously, neither does John. He's given us what he can. How do you, again, describe the indescribable? Worthy is the Lamb who has been, worthy is the Lamb who was slain. Okay? Anyway, and I'll just break off the worship right there. But anyway, worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and riches and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and blessing. Now notice the response to what they just said. And every creature, not just every tribe, tongue, and nation, all the peoples. No. This is beyond just the peoples and all the tribes and languages. This is every creature. Now this reminds me of Paul talking about there in Romans that creation itself is groaning because you and I have messed it up. And it's groaning, waiting for the day to be released when we, our redemption is made evident and creation is set free from the garbage that we have put on it as man. Interesting stuff. And every creature, notice, in case you were confused, which is in heaven, well, that takes care of that, and on the earth, and even under the earth, and such as are in the sea, and all that are in them. In other words, everything with breath. Sound familiar? Sounds like the Psalms, doesn't it? Let everything that has breath praise the Lord. Everything. Well, fishes don't have breath. Yes, they do. It's just different than yours. Trees have breath, right? They breathe in, what is it, carbon monoxide or dioxide, whatever. Breathe out oxygen, whatever it is. I'm not a tree guy. Juan, what does it do? I knew there'd be an ash. There had to be a break to get to Juan. I just knew there was. Blessing and honor. Oh, and then so all these things, what is it that they're saying? Notice that the redeemed have the song of redemption. The second psalm is the angel, the angelic host. It's a song of reception. He's going to receive that which is due him. And now look at here again. Blessing and honor and glory and power. Sounds like they were paying attention to what the heavenly host was singing. Blessing and honor and glory and power be to him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. And there it is, forever and ever. And one last verse. Then the four living creatures said, Amen. So whether or not they were involved in everything that was said before, or whether they were sort of capping it off with the Amen, we don't know. But either way, the living creatures said Amen, and the 24 elders fell down and worshipped him who lives forever and ever. Unbelievable. Chapter 5. And all of this is set before chapter 6, in case you're confused. 5 comes before 6. It's like that dumb commercial, Flonase. Well, these others only do one, and the Flonase does 6. Every time I hear this commercial, I'm like, really, dude? And he goes, and 6 is greater than 1. No. Now, there's something I didn't know. It's like, what is wrong with people? But anyways, chapter 5 is going to lead us into chapter 6. And you better understand chapter 5 if you're going to understand what's 6 and what comes behind it. And hopefully, we've at least established some sort of a foundation. Because what we're talking about is the one who was here with us on earth. And on that last night, established something that would keep us mindful of this until we're in that presence. So if we can get the folks to come forward and pass out the elements. That